Well, where the fudge did that year go, eh? I'm Mike. Welcome to Sounds from the Ziggurat Podcast, Episode 7, your released at random taste of the Brighton music scene of the noughties and more. First of all, a warning. There will be some Christmas vibes scattered throughout this edition of the podcast, considering its December release. But fear not, due to strict licensing laws that are in effect, I do not have permission to play any of the usual holiday tunes, or indeed, anthems. This episode will be jam-packed with content, as my release schedule went a bit wonky towards the end of this year, and there are a few loose ends I would like to cover and tie up by the end of the show. If you do stick around to the end of the podcast, we will finally hear part one of the Infurion interview that I've been teasing for the past few episodes. I have managed to edit together some safe-for-work rambling for myself, Adam and Simon, where we discuss our early musical influences and what it was like being in a band together. I can assure maximum bants all round. There will also be a bit of a half-hearted review of a Concord 2 gig I attended recently, featuring A, Wheatus and Inme, and a fond look back at one of my favourite places to club in the 2000s, the almighty Gloucester. Personally, at the time of writing, I'm still looking for employment, so if you know of any jobs where I can sit on the sofa playing Zelda Breath of the Wild, write some music, or become an undercover pub spy, please do get in touch. Having the option to lie in is a definite plus point too, make a note of that. For the record, I have been given some temp work in the Argus warehouse over Christmas, and I'm about to record this podcast at around 11:30 a.m, straight after a 12 a.m. to 8 a.m. night shift, so apologies if I start to sound a little hoarse. I also just want to mention that I've started branching out on the YouTube channel now as well, and I've changed the name from Sounds of the Ziggurat to From the Ziggurat to accommodate this. The reason is so that I can narcissistically talk about some of my other interests outside of music, primarily retro gaming. This will only exist on the YouTube channel though, and won't be clogging up the Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast on your favourite client. So check out the YouTube channel if you want to hear me ramble about my memories of the Commodore 64 and its games. To start the show, we have a track from the new EP from Lewis McHale. This is Snowflakes from the Snowflakes EP.
It's clear, let's enjoy ourselves this Christmas time and don't get down with fear. The snow will fall, but we all stand tall. Goes by. Let's hope the next is right. We will make it through the hard old times and make the future bright. The snow will fall, but we all stand tall. To try and make things good, we are told we're wrong and that we're soft. Let's hope things look up. The snow will fall, but we all stand tall. The snow will fall, but we all stand tall.
Find Lewis's new Christmas-infused EP over at bandcamp.com. And while you're there, taunt him at how bad he is at non-branded Jenga. As mentioned in a previous podcast, I hope to get my friend Moog on for a chat about his different musical projects. From, but not limited to, chap rock guitar-infused rapscallion, through to eclectic cover band Spook, and also this band, the fabulously titled Wonky Beak. I asked Moog for a little background info about the band, and what he sent back was more articulate than anything I could construct, so I'm just going to rip it off word for word. Wonky Beak was a strange collective of eight members, the brainchild of musical genius Andy Graney, who strove to create something completely different, yet totally accessible. Well, for the most part. The Beak was unusual in it comprising of three singers, two-part horn section, delicious, classically trained keys and thundering punk backline, and had songs that often none of the members particularly understood the meaning of. Andy had been influenced strongly by Queen, Talking Heads and Prince, but drew inspiration from just about anywhere. The songs were most often bizarrely humorous and abstract, with songs as diverse as the decline of Hollywood film, the joy of life, and even necrophilia. Stage antics were theatrical, with plans made for weeks to produce a one-off show. One thing you could be sure of, if the Beak were playing, you were dancing. Or at least squinting in a bemused manner at the stage. Tragically, Andy, along with a number of Brighton's great musicians, were killed in a terrible motorway accident, way before their time or their potential was reached. In some small consolation, they live on in the music they left behind. We'll hear more from Moog in the new year. This is Wonky Beak with a version of Get Creative, recorded live at the Providence on the 24th of February, 2006.
We're Wonky Beak.
Create.
Thanks very much.
One of my absolute favourite venues in Brighton in the 2000s was the Gloucester. Being just under 18 with no ID, I had unfortunately been kept out of the Hungry Years in its final months, and so my first experience of hearing rock and metal music in a loud, non-gig setting was here. To be honest, I think my friends and I had some years where we were in there most nights. Our evening usually revolved around a few pints and frames of bar billiards at the Albion pub in Hanover. Mick the barman was always pleasant to us, even when we took over the jukebox and created a playlist of tunes slightly out of character with the regular patrons of the pub. We would then wander 5 minutes down the road to the Gloucester. Thursdays was a classic rock night, Tuesdays was more current rock, metal and emo music, Fridays was alternative nights, and Saturday was a school disco, where you could don your old uniform, or sometimes get away with your old Summerfield uniform, to save you £7 entrance fee, which on reflection is quite steep. There were also other nights here as well, including Gaz's Homewrecker, which had a visit from Rock Sound magazine. A few of us were quoted inside the magazine alongside our pictures, which was highly exciting. However, I redacted the original story I gave them after a crisis of conscience and replaced it with a rather more acceptable tale. The Gloucester was a club for alternative types of people, or anyone that wanted to avoid the perils of West Street and its trendy identikit dress codes and off-putting police presence. One of the most striking things about the Gloucester at this time was its dance floor. It was full of lights underneath for a maximum disco effect that could sometimes render one totally spaced out after a couple of quad damages whilst taking part in a good-mannered mosh to Slipknot or Deftones. A couple of our mates who will remain nameless used to pace around like they owned the joint, checking out all the girls they would set in their sights to chat to, but usually remained too fearful to approach. After a night of intense headbanging or dancing, we would often head to the kebab shop along the road, and then over to the level, to gallivant on the swings and other less than safe activities, like running up and down the skateboard ramps and walking along the trellis. Aside from a couple of fights, a crippling accident, and a near swimming pool related death, it was quite fun. When I first started going to the Gloucester, there were three bars to purchase drinks from, with the one by the entrance dedicated to imaginatively named shooters and other treats. This was, of course, if you wanted to deviate from the £1.50 bottles of Newcastle Brown Ale, or what became the staple diet of young rockers, Snakebite and Black. If you wanted to avoid breaking the bank by paying a whole pound to put your coat or bag in the cloakroom, you could simply lift up the chair furnishings and hide your apparel inside the seats for the evening. I guess this wasn't the safest thing to do, but the general vibe was usually one of appreciative and like-minded people, all just wanting to have a good time, so it was accepted. Another reason the Gloucester will always be special to me is down to the friendships that I forged, and most importantly, because it's where I met my partner Petter. Clubbing in this fashion really was a good way to get introduced to old and new music, as it's quite easy to miss even the most classic of bands growing up, if someone doesn't directly introduce you to them. BBC Six Music took over a lot of this whilst I stressed away in an office over these past few years, but it's within the loud and dingy walls of a club that some beautiful relationships with music are often formed. I was introduced to classics from the likes of Nine Inch Nails and Jurassic 5, to cracking modern singles from Funeral for a Friend, Slipknot, and I'm afraid to say, The Lost Prophets. I regret not seeing The Hungry Years, and I also wish I was around for the Acid House days down at the seafront area of clubs, as they look, fun. One particular Tuesday night was extra special to us. The DJ ended the evening by playing the Infirium version of Santa Claus is Coming to Town, which sent everybody fucking nuts. Unfortunately, in later years, you can see the gradual decline of punters in the Gloucester. This can be attributed to a few things. Firstly, they had a revamp at one stage and removed the disco floor, which was one of its best qualities. They cleaned it up and unstickied everything too, which didn't help in my opinion. Some of the vibe had been lost. However, the smoking ban, later opening hours for pubs, and rising drinks prices certainly had a hand in it too. The final nail in the coffin is when the Barfly took over. I'm sure their intentions were good at first, with the vision to bring more bands down to play gigs in the venue, but ultimately it didn't survive and was closed down. Nowadays, the pub has reopened as the North Lane Brewhouse, where it houses its own brewery behind the bar where we used to sit. It's an open environment that hosts DJs, quizzes and occasional live music. They serve food and have bottomless brunches for those out for a bite or wreckheads recovering from the night before. My only complaint is that it can often get really loud. You may think that's just me getting old, but no, I think it's more them trying to force atmosphere into the room by making the young and old alike shout their nuts off to have a casual conversation. I like loudness, but here it seems like they need a speaker upgrade if they want to pump it up past 11, because the sound of my last couple of visits was atrocious. Overall, I'm happy that something was done with the building instead of sitting derelict for however long it was. And it is a nice place to hang out and have a few beers, despite following the Brighton trend of having to remortgage my flat to afford any. We'll be right back. Friend of the podcast, Greenside, has his first tracks released in September 2017 on Brighton label Horizon Recordings. It is not the first time we've had one of his projects played on the podcast. You may remember Brett was bassist in Slaughterhouse 57, which I featured in one of our early episodes. Nowadays, he creates brooding electronic landscapes, lush sounds and melancholic textures under the moniker Greenside, citing a range of influences from Massive Attack, Manu Shrine, Joy Division, Burial, Ghost Dark, Irrelevant and Honey Ruin, combined with the sound of Future Garage, Force of Habit, and dub reggae. The unusual cherry on top of this myriad of influences is the theme to the Michael Caine movie Get Carter, not the far superior Sly Stallone remake. Just kidding, I haven't seen either. As for Brett himself, if you want to have a surefire shot at winning a music quiz, he seems to be the chap you want on your side. The self-confessed music nerd has taken on entire pubs by himself and come out victorious. One likely reason for this is his eclectic taste in music. The soundtrack to his life ranges from punk bands such as Leatherface and Snuff, to dub reggae, 90s drum and bass and Future Garage, from Debussy to Throbbing Gristle and one of my favourites, Joy Division. His admiration for experimental sounds is so strong that he once couldn't tell that the radio was simply not tuned into a station, and instead he was casually listening to the white noise and interference glistening through the speaker. Brett started playing in punk bands back in 1999. This was back in a time of anxiety and the prospect of chaos and Armageddon. The world was about to come crashing down due to the Y2K bug, and great Saturday evening TV was to come to an end with the cancellation of Noel's house party. Brett started in God's Lonely Men after his friend Ollie asked when he was going to learn the bass guitar he already had sitting in his room, and the band began despite Brett not being able to play. He worked his way into Slaughterhouse when the band approached him to put a Bassist Wanted poster up in the shop he used to work in called Wildcat. He didn't indulge them and instead went to the rehearsal himself. After leaving Slaughterhouse 57, he joined supergroup The Sweet Zeros, made from members of Prissy Crush, Mr. Green Vendetta and Best Left Dead. It's like a sort of southeast of England punk version of the Travelling Wilburys. I'm hoping to feature Mr. Green Vendetta at some point in the future on the podcast. I'm patiently hoping for a call or a text. Gentle reminder if you're listening. After The Sweet Zeros, Brett formed Gira Dement before eventually going electronic a few years later, drawn to the ever-evolving underground music scene. He doesn't have any current plans to play live, but you can check out the tunes at soundcloud.com/greenside. And also note that you can check out his recording label, thesound.audio, and also soundcloud.com/darkheartrecordings, where you hear a collection of Future Garage artists. This is Greenside with Dark Heart. I visited the Concorde 2 recently to see my pals Gaz and Tom play with their band In Me. The Concorde 2 is one of those love and hate venues for me. The bar's big, the sound is usually pretty good, and it's just far enough along the seafront that I don't have to go into town to get to it. Its worst quality is its tiny toilets, which can get rather packed in between sets, and it is sometimes that I can get a bit of stage fright. I have been here on club nights where they open the toilets at the back of the venue, which is very welcome, but obviously for a gig it's not an option. Fun fact, Gaz and I once shared a fun lock-in when our friend Lou was managing the St George's pub in Cape Town. He spent half the night giving me advice and coaching me through my fear of urinating in front of other people. My other concern about the Concorde 2 is it sometimes seems too quiet, but I fear that could be my hearing, starting to admit defeat after many screams of surprise feedback. As I've spoken about on the podcast before, I met Gaz in the Gladstone many years back and we became good friends and musical acquaintances. I actually have plans to remix the first project we did together, the Seagull Samaritan EP that I recorded with him almost 10 years ago in my old shared house in Modine. Gaz joined In Me shortly after that and has been the lead guitarist and integral member to the band ever since. Our friend Tom, who was one of the drummers in Dry Rise, luckily whilst I was also in the band, has recently joined In Me too, ready to help take them to the next stage of their musical and social progression. The band put on a solid performance overall. My only criticism is that they only had a half an hour slot, which means a lot of the older songs take precedence over the new. I would personally prefer to hear a lot of the heavier, more melodic material from the past 10 years, but it was awesome to get a run out of the cracking opener Rivery Shores and new single For Something to Happen. Their shorter set was of course due to the fact they went on stage first, opening up before Wheatus and A. I was pleasantly surprised with A, they seemed to hold the crowd well and deliver a very competent performance. I was also surprised that they started their set with the single they are primarily known for, the anthem Nothing. I assumed this would have come at the end, despite knowing they were to play their album Hi-Fi Sirius in full. Wheatus were an odd one to see, and you could tell that although they didn't shy away from that one song that put them on the map, they had a lot more they wanted to convey to the audience. Overall, a great night was had. 4.5 out of 5 riffs. One thing I really enjoy is getting music recommendations from my friends. There's something so much more personal about being given a CD or mixtape by someone who has known you for years with new music to listen to. There was a small period where I received a couple of mix CDs from my dear friend and primary Rise of the Ziggurat artist Daz while he was studying at uni. I think one of the many things I missed out on by not going on to further study was the wealth of new music it would have introduced me to. A lot of it that people take for granted. That and of course I might have some sort of education as well. These CDs were my first forays into artists such as Daniel Johnston, CSS and Boards of Canada. They were full to the brim with an eclectic mix of tracks by some famous and some lesser known artists and featured hand-drawn track listings and doodles on the packaging. Although I do see its convenience to some degree, I will always prefer content like this over Spotify playlists and other similar suggestions based on algorithms. Although I do enjoy it, especially with this low-wage friendly 99p for 3 months special offer, I actually believe streaming is the record company's way of fighting back and taking control once again, most likely at the expense of the artist. It's all very well getting rid of your MP3s, CDs and vinyl to subscribe to a music service, but what if your favourite artist wants to leave that service? What if they make their own subscription service? Do you then have to join too because that's the only way of listening to the songs you love now? You can't rely on YouTube anymore because that's full of ads, unless of course you pay their subscription as well. Then of course all the tunes you have paid the license for just exist as noughts and ones on your account, so there's no legal way of passing the music you love down to anyone, or sharing it with others to enjoy. And then what if the internet goes down? I don't know, maybe I'm being paranoid, but Dave keeps talking to me about these soul catchers on the moon and I don't know. Wait, what? Anyway, I digress. One of the tracks featured on the second CD I was sent by Daz was a beautiful anti-folk track called Gone by the Fisher-Price Landmine. It was sometime in 2006 that multi-instrumentalist James and his friend Sophie attended a gig at the Prince Albert, watching Jana Hunter and Ray Raposa of the Castanets. They were in awe of what they had heard and discussed experimenting with something similar themselves following the gig. Although Sophie would not call herself a singer, James noticed that she would occasionally burst into song with the aid of the greatest Johnny Vaughan approved cider money can buy, Strongbow. And a few days later, they met up to jam through a few ideas James had been working on. Sophie gravitated towards a particular set of tracks and accompanied them with some amazing harmonies straight away. Sophie would also introduce a bass guitar despite never learning how to play the instrument, and the pair would meet up every week, work on a song James had written, and upload it to popular, at the time at least, musical networking site MySpace, where everyone had a friend called Tom, who is now a retired millionaire. Well done, Tom. Well done. James and Sophie were soon joined by Deb, who came on board to add some drums and guitar. And instead of heading out to the local pub in search of some exposure, the group started playing their first gigs in people's living rooms and continued to make more recordings. When the band were invited to play their debut show, ironically supporting the Castanets, who were partly the inspiration for their existence, they jumped at the chance. Aside from Deb, who by this time had moved away to continue her studies at university. It was at this gig that the duo were approached by one of the support acts, Jessica Ryland, to contribute to a mixtape for label Death Bomb Arc. But instead of sending out the initial recordings that took root on MySpace, they recorded a live 4-track cassette, which became the only recording the band ever released. After a couple more shows, Sophie left to go to university, and sadly, that was the end of Fisher-Price Lamwin. James says that the main idea behind the group was the celebration of the different characters of its members, from Sophie's positivity and confidence to his awkward pessimism. James' lyrics were sincere with a twist of sarcasm, making them sentimental and tongue-in-cheek, whereas the music was supposed to reflect Sophie's optimistic and sweet demeanour. Their MySpace site, like all of our MySpace sites, sit there in a graveyard of times gone by. Tiny boxes representing past acquaintances are still viewable, some low-quality photos capturing a snapshot of the past on display, but the music lies dead. I hope in the future that the back catalogue does find its way onto Bandcamp or something similar, and if it does happen, I will be sure to let you know. I'm sure it's not the last time we will discuss the Fisher-Price Landmine on the podcast. On a side note, it turns out James went on to play in a band Uncle Buck between the years of 2002 and 2004, so he and I would definitely have shared the stage in our respective bands in another lifetime. It's funny how things come around. This is the Fisher-Price Landmine with Gone.
I always hope there's something to anticipate when all this ends. And will I cope waiting outside pearly gates, waiting for my thank you. down now, your offspring, your elbow before you pass on. And will we get the answers, and will they enhance us, or will we just be gone? What happens when you don't know your offspring, your elbow before you pass on? And will we get the answers, and will they enhance us, or will we just be gone? What happens when you don't know your offspring, your elbow before you pass on? And will we get the answers, and will they enhance us, or will we just be gone? What happens when you don't know your offspring, your elbow before you pass on? And will we get the answers, and will they enhance us, or will we just be gone?
No, fuck.
Right,
just keep going.
The last tune today is going to be a Christmas song recorded by Rise of the Ziggurat and Friends. To those of you with a keen ear, you will notice that the name of this act is similar to the name of this podcast, which is because, yep, you guessed it, I am all out of ideas. This version of We Three Kings was born from an acoustic rendition that I had come up with over the course of a couple of months, and slowly written additional harmonies and melodies in my head, with the vague hope that I might be able to get some of my friends and family to help finish it. Luckily, some of them happened to be over at our shared house one drunken Christmas Eve, and it was decided that we crack out the mics and start recording the upcoming frenzy. A lot of nonsense came from this session, but we did manage to capture a chaotic ramble and complete the track in the early hours of Christmas morning. This was a tremendously fun experience, but I felt we could do more justice to the song with some extra care and attention. So a few years later, I recorded another version that was to become mildly definitive. Of course, did I learn from my mistakes? Maybe not get quite so smashed so early, and perhaps actually learn how to produce a professional sounding track? Fuck no! I laid down the backing, subcontracted the percussion out to my mate Gary, and assembled the choir in my brother's basement kitchen for another drunken sing-along session. I also received choruses sent to me online from Liquid Audio Brian, who was in Australia at the time, and stems from our buddy Tom, who had recently abandoned me to move to York, where in the summer it peaks at about 8 degrees. This is Rise of the Ziggurat, with vocals and other help from Petter, Dave, Sai, Keely, Jada, Sai, Lou, Moog, Sam, Tom and Brian, and the track is We Three Kings.
Star of
Right, we have made it through to the roundtable interview. You have heard me blab on enough about Inferion on previous podcasts, so I won't take you through it for the 50th time. Again, there may be a longer version of this added to YouTube at some point in the future for those hardcore types, and part 2 should appear next year in season 2 of Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast. There are some sudden fades and gaps, I apologise for this, but there are some things the world doesn't need to hear. Drink-wise, Ad and I on some sort of craft brew, I believe was called Ripper, and Sai is on the Shandy. We will pick up the conversation discussing a previous episode of the podcast. This was episode 7, and the last in the current series of Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast. Thanks to everyone who listened and supported myself and the podcast this year, and an extra special thanks to those who have given their blessing to play a track, which is mostly every act. Whatever your beliefs or non-beliefs, have a nice period of days between December the 24th and January the 2nd. Happy Christmas, tremendous new year, and thanks for listening. I'm going to bed. Good night.
It was weird listening to that podcast and hearing that song, because like, as soon as I heard it, I was like, oh, I recognise this.
Yeah. But that's the thing, there isn't, that's the whole reason of doing it, because there are a few tracks, I mean, not everyone's going to love it, but there are just some good tracks that are just going to be forgotten about, because, you know, everyone moves on, the bands move on, the fans move on.
Oh my god, when he started going on a bit. Like the first bit where he said about meeting Francis Rossi.
Yeah,
like,
I was dying.
Oh
my god. I was dying. Then I met wannabe Francis Rossi. Adam Martin. And all I thought straight away was when I first met you with Mike going to Gap. Outside Sainsbury's at London Road.
Oh, yeah.
And you said, sorry, this is Adam, who's coming to play bass for us. And I was like, fucking hell. Dressed as Rossi. Because you were dressed up in your waistcoat.
Oh, it's, yeah. It's a good look.
And I was like, really?
I stood out from the crowd.
You definitely stood out from the crowd.
Obviously had the desired effects.
That was one way, yeah. It's,
your life's just been a continual stand out from the crowd.
Yeah.
Ambition.
I'm like David Bowie, I just morph into the next phase of my look.
Yeah, but I think David Bowie was doing his own thing, and not just morphing into everyone else's phases.
Well, this is true. Yeah.
Well, what can I say, Mike? I was in a whole family's in a marching band.
Yeah.
Cousins, sister, all the cousins.
Was it just like a family tradition or something?
I don't know. I don't know. It started, to be fair. I really don't know. All I remember from early age was just being in a marching band. And I wanted to play the snare at first, because that was cool, and it made loads of noise. But because I was about 2 foot tall, I couldn't hold the snare. So they put me on cymbals. Oh yes, cymbals. So yeah, I put me on cymbals, and then I went on to a cornet.
Cornet?
Cornet, which is a smaller version of a trumpet.
I thought it was one of those things that is full of ice cream and chocolate.
I had many of them as well. Yeah, they went to cornet, and then it's a smaller version of trumpet. And then they realised that I was unbelievable, and then went on to trumpet.
How many buttons does a cornet have?
Cornet has three. Three bells.
So it's basically a trumpet.
Yeah, but it's basically a trumpet half the size.
Ah.
And a slightly different pitch.
Yeah. Okay.
So I started with that, and then I went on to a trumpet. Realised I was a natural, unbelievable person that I was. And had a gift. And basically went off to trumpet, and because I was...
Sounds like a Christmas movie.
Because there was... there was two marching bands. There was a youth marching band, and there was a senior marching band. And because I was in the middle and good enough to do seniors, I do both bands.
So therefore
I had two shows to learn.
Yeah.
Obviously you're not just standing still, you're doing a show.
You only have three buttons, can't be that hard.
Only three buttons, no. many notes. Pretty bad. So I had to learn two sets of music. I remember once being theme music for the youth was Oliver.
Oh yeah.
And the theme music for the seniors was Queen.
So
I had to learn two lots of music, two lots of shows. You're making shapes in a form, I don't know if you've ever seen it before. So you're either,
I saw your video.
Yeah, indoor, like in America, it's massive.
Whole football field.
You have
just
to play.
To play.
It's huge out there. And now the NFL pitches. And there's like 200 members to a band.
Yeah.
And it's just one of the things, it's just massive out there. So we were doing over here.
And then you were what, rehearsing in Whippingham Hall, or was that somewhere else?
Whippingham Hall.
I remember going out to Whippingham Hall and trying out for it.
Yeah, Whippingham Hall. And then we went up to the Race Hill.
Oh, what, actually in the Compass?
Race Hill, yeah, the Race Hill. As you look at it on the, if you look at the Race Hill, on the right hand side, I mean, the far is right side to go round.
Yeah.
There's a hall there, that's where we used to play. And we used to rehearse out on the grass in the summer.
It's quite nice out there, on the
It was great, yeah.
When did you leave that then?
When the horses started stampeding towards him.
Guys, get out of the way!
Yeah, when it was race day, it was a nightmare.
Stupid jockeys!
I've done that for. The good thing about that was that I got to play Birmingham, NEC Arena, Wembley, Royal Albert Hall, in front of the Queen, and got to win all these competitions.
Yeah,
and I'd say I was national champion 3 years running.
Wow.
And I was an absolute don.
Well, on that bombshell, Ad, how can you follow that? What did you do before being in band?
Well, I first started kind of ish on guitar when my parents got me a plastic electric guitar from the Argos catalogue.
Nice.
Which came with a plastic microphone and a little plastic amp.
Oh, so it's a proper guitar, like,
you're playing? No, it's awful. It wouldn't stay in tune, and it all just went through this one little speaker.
So what songs did you learn on this plastic guitar?
Oh, I couldn't play anything. It was awful. It just wouldn't stay in tune.
Later, you would mimic that with your vocal cords.
nothing has changed since.
I was holding back then.
Let it go.
Like Frozen, just let it go.
I was holding back then.
So when did you upgrade to a real guitar?
Well,
when are you going to upgrade to a real guitar?
So I basically couldn't play that, so I gave up and didn't play an instrument for a while. And then when I went to Falmer, they were asking if people wanted to play instruments, which I said yes, but unfortunately it was more classical kind of things, and all the instruments have been allocated for my year, so I ended up with a fucking tuba, which was...
That's incredible. Is there any photographic evidence of this?
No, but it was literally as big as me, and I had to fucking walk home with it, which is ridiculous. I had it was in like a bloody hard case as well, and I had like shoulder straps, and I was just lugging it up the hill.
You needed like a cornet sized tuba to a mini tuba or something.
So I think I played that for about 6 months and then gave up, and I was like, sod that, I want to play guitar. Yes. And then I think I got some horrendous acoustic which didn't stay in tune, and then finally I upgraded to get a cheap Telecaster copy from Impact Music. Oh, which is now Badlands.
Now Badlands.
Obviously, yeah.
I earn five quid every time we mention Badlands in the podcast.
He's mugging you off.
Graham, I'll do it for four. Carry on.
I found out a bit later, because I still got that original guitar, which I managed to get signed by Status Quo.
Why did you devalue it in this way?
Because they were doing a record signing, and I was like, well, I've got to...
Did you ever get anything else signed?
More now.
Just a CD.
Who was the CD you signed?
Oh, there was a time I was at college, and I think I was on my way home, and Gary Marshall was going on his way to work, and he stopped me in the street and begged me to go to HMV to get a Martin McCutcheon album signed. And I was there, I was standing in the queue with a load of bloody kids queuing up in my leather jacket and Metallica t-shirt, and as I got nearer and nearer to the front of the queue, her bodyguards were basically like looking at me like, hang on a minute, we shouldn't let this guy through.
Did you get anything out of that experience?
No, I think I did it for free, at the goodness of my heart. Ridiculous.
Just the kind of guy you were.
Yeah.
Always at the good part.
Wow. Well, my first ever album that I bought was a, I mean, it, perfect now because of where I've ended up, but it was a glam rock greatest hits cassette. Yeah.
Nice.
I think I probably got that for Christmas or my birthday or something from my parents.
Was it one of those double cassettes that you used to get with a...
No, it was only a single cassette. But it had a lot.
Probably had about
size.
300 songs on it. Yeah. So, what about you, sir? What do you remember listening to when you were growing up?
I was just trying to think when you asked that question. Anything, really.
For the record, for me, it was Michael Jackson, who's on now.
It is. I'll just do anything. I'll listen to pop music, I'll listen to R&B, rap, rock, anything that got me moving.
Which is R&B before it got really sleazy a bit later on.
Yes, I'm talking Shaggy.
I was not expecting you to say that.
Who's now working with Sting.
What?
Yes, I saw that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I did see
as
that.
As he was known, the police.
Yes, I saw that, yes. I think one of my first cassette tapes was Shaggy.
It wasn't me, I assume, or...
No, Carolina. Yeah.
Oh, I used to have that on cassette.
Yeah,
it was on, like, a compilation thing of, like, the 90s or something.
That's one of my first ones. Yeah, I used anything. And obviously, when I was in a band, obviously, marching band, I'd be listening to things that we were playing.
I was always quite impressed by your massive collections of rave tapes, and I really wish I had some now. You used to have those, didn't you?
Yeah, I could do with them now. I'll listen to anything that would get me moving.
But those big like plastic, like Ministry of Sound things.
Ministry of Sound, Pol Pot. I've off my nut in them.
They were tremendous. They were really good little compilations. I wish I actually had some now.
DJ Sly.
Check out Deanne Woods.
Who?
Exactly. Yeah. Just that. Check them out. They're tremendous.
I love your look. Yeah,
it's
anything.
Like old school
rave,
but weird as fuck.
I think it all depends on what mood I was in.
Yeah.
I'd put that on, then I'd go and put Elton John on. Then I'd go and listen to Oliver music because that's what I'm learning in the marching band. I'd be all over the place.
Yeah.
No wonder I feel like I'm on a roller coaster ride. Everything was all over the place.
You were quite eclectic back then.
Yeah, anything.
So then we were playing together at school.
Yes, when we got a drum kit in.
Oh, that's when you had your one fill.
Whoa! Yes. I mastered very well. And could we note there that Ad got the first insult in? Many people would have had a bet on me to do that.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
Hang on, you already mentioned my vocals.
No, I didn't.
Oh, Mike.
Yes.
I held back.
I actually took a sip of my drink for that reason. I learned the drums. I learned to play the drums through.
Well, when was that?
Oh! Goosh!
Right, fuck it. Gloves are off. My dad used to teach percussion in the marching band.
Who did?
My dad used to teach percussion.
Your dad?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah,
I don't recall that either.
He used to teach percussion line.
Was it like dad gang percussion?
All the like paradiddles. My dad's unbelievable, so. But obviously it's all just a snare.
I never knew this.
Yeah.
You learn something new every day.
Rock or the music.
I don't recall him ever coming in like trying to play or anything.
No.
He'd come in and play dad gag guitars.
Yeah. Fucking shit.
Drove
me insane. But he's quality. But no, he taught the percussion line.
Oh, right, okay. That's really cool. I didn't realise. Well, I forgot about it. Yeah.
So I always had snares and drumsticks and pads at home.
Yeah, yeah.
Hence why I knew how to play a snare.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I'd be at school and teach us over the snare and do all these stick movements, that was from that.
Yeah, okay.
So that's how I knew. And then obviously when we'd miss it around at band practice, I'd get on a snare and then... So I knew how to play a drum. And then I thought, oh, a drum kit coming to school. I should be able to adapt to the rest of the kit. Great way to get out of lessons.
I do remember getting to French and at one point and just be like, I'm going to go play music now.
I remember going to my French class, which was your tutor at the time.
Oh, blimey, okay.
Roughly.
Oh, yeah.
And going, why am I learning this? This is shit. I am, although I probably didn't use the word shit, I probably said probably crap.
You said nerd.
Yeah.
Said what?
Nerd.
I didn't know that much French, man. So I just said, I'm going down to my tutors. And I basically left the class. Just went. And then she's come down at the end of the lesson and said, do you know Simon walked out of French class today? And Mr. Stokes went, yeah, he's in the back with the bass guitar.
Quality. Mr. Stokes was the DT teacher who played bass for half of the school band.
He was also my tutor.
And he was Sy's tutor, yeah.
He said, yeah, he's in the back playing bass.
We'd go to his class and play Need for Speed on his computer and stuff.
Oh, wow, well, there we go.
So he was like, she was like, dude.
Oh. He was a top dude and possibly the reason that Sy and I are not very well educated.
Well, at least you got an excuse.
Okay, so how did we progress from getting together, well, Pete moving away, and then suddenly we're at your house every morning, pointing to Simon, at Sy's house every morning, Ad was cooking breakfast, and then we were set up for the day. How did that come about?
I think that basically happened because college finished, and we had nothing to do. And we were like, right, let's record an EP. Let's go and practice every
basically,
day.
Basically, mum and dad, lucky for us, allowed us to have a nice spare room as a studio. Because all the neighbours were at work during the day.
Yeah, yeah.
Which meant we could play during the day, and then when everybody turned up to play in the evening, we'd stop.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was handy. We used that as a rehearsal room. And
but the mornings used to be like a kind of social
morning
thing,
Ad would
come down as well.
Ad would come down and cook breakfast,
sometimes burn the ceiling
and sometimes set fire to my kitchen, which he did.
And it then, did give us a good range of merchandise from Cafe Presto. Chef Ad, aprons, Chef Ad,
whatever Ad did in my house always came back to me. What have you done now, Sy? Hey, Ad.
Are you talking about the throwing up incident?
Yes, I am. Well, I'm talking about an incident where we went out one night and was completely wasted. So I said, why don't you just crash in my house? So he just crashed in my house. And then
literally, I think I just smashed just over crashed. A chair.
He literally fell into my bedroom and knocked a chair flying. And they woke my dad up. Dad's come out and said, what sort of noise? And I went, have a look. So he looked in my room and just saw Ad on the floor, passed out with his chair on top of his head. And all my dad said was, he's had a good time.
What are we talking about?
I was like, okay, well, we did some recording, we got EPs done,
bang.
And then we went out to play live. As far as I can recall, well, no, actually, as far as I can recall, Brighton, it was mainly Cable Club side, gave us our first gig, tremendous chat.
Hang on, first gig, Whippingham Hall.
But, yeah, if we want to take it back to our first gig, it would have been Whippingham Hall.
I mean, I don't want to drag this on all night, but...
No.
Was that the first?
Yeah, the Christmas one at Whippingham Hall, the first Christmas one.
Nettle Kettle Presents Christmas 2001 or something.
Yeah, where me and Mike opened with an acoustic set.
That is a thing that happened, holy crap.
Where I badly performed some Radiohead.
George Harrison.
Oh my god. Wow.
I think Gavin had his own.
Yeah, Gavin did a set.
Yeah.
Chris almost fell over on a skateboard.
Yeah. I forgot about that. He fucking improved on my drum skin.
Yeah.
The sound in there was terrible because it was a Turn tool.
Yeah.
So it's just a big kind of echoey mess. But it looked good.
Yeah.
It looked good because we had all the decorations and that done as well by.
Before all that, I remember the previous lineup with Peter.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Us getting ready to play our first gig.
Really?
And saying to Pete, so are you ready to do this live? Like, are we ready to go and do some gigging? And him being absolutely terrified. Sorry, Pete, do you listen to this?
So what you're saying, Ty, is it was lucky I stepped into the void.
Things just happen for a reason,
really. Now I'm
yes.
There we go.
That's the kind of thing we did though back in the day. We liked putting on our own gigs. We liked being in control of the situation. Most of the promoters that we would have played for were quite cool. They were quite cool players, you know. But it was always fun kind of putting on our own stuff. So we had like Whippenham Hall where we did the first Metal Kettle Presents Christmas. That was good. And then I guess after that, how did Long Hill come about? We played Long Hill School for some reason.
Mosh for Dosh.
Yes. Why was that a thing? I literally can't remember.
I don't know, but that was with which band was that?
Sideshow, Wookie.
Yeah.
All I remember is that everyone else was playing like 20-25 minute sets of their little kind of pop songs, and then we went on and played a 45 minute set of our own stuff.
I believe we would have
stuff
done
in there.
Yeah, we did Through the Bell Tolls, Fade to Black medley.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Staple.
We did Mobiles and Squandered, which were both about 8 minutes long.
Yeah. To which the crowd of like 11-year-olds probably weren't quite into.
They bloody loved it, Mike. There we go, mental.
They're going, okay, fair enough. Some girl got kicked out because not our band, because someone didn't they jump off the stage and like knock someone out.
Maybe.
Is it you? Is that what you're looking so weird about this though? You knocked someone out.
That was the gig where he knocked his bloody cymbals into my brand new Kramer Explorer, took a massive chunk out the back of it. I literally only got it that week.
Wasn't it that day?
It might have been that day. Standing there at the microphone, singing, and just felt something hit somewhere. And then I look around and the cymbals on the floor, and then I kind of look at the corner of the guitar. There's just a slice down the back of it. Frick.
Yeah, we got that gig.
How did we get that gig?
I laughed so much, I knew it was going to come up. I forgot it was coming up then. I thought it was that gig.
I'm not sure if you remember that.
I'd forgotten until you started laughing, and I was like, hang on a minute.
When we literally say his guitar had just landed, he literally just landed in the country 3 hours before the gig.
Ridiculous.
And this was before we used to get stumped with loads of import tax as well.
It wasn't.
Yeah. Oh, it wasn't. Someone else was paying it for us.
The best thing about this was...
Your nan was paying it.
It was delivered to my nan's address and the import tax thing came through a couple of weeks later and my nan said, hang on, you've got a letter through the post that says you owe like tax like 80 quid or something for this guitar. And I was like, well, I'm sure it didn't say that when I ordered it. And she was like, right, well, I'll get on to them then.
You threw your nan under the bus.
My nan phones them up and basically argued their way out of it. And I'm sure I did owe them that amount of money,
but she
blagged her way out of it. So.
Wow, well done, Nan.
Well done, Nan.
Yeah, well done. You needed that money to repair the guitar.
All right, okay, I've got to bring this back.
Oh, sorry, yeah, we've gone on the tangent.
I don't mind the tangent, but it's opening up new avenues that we should probably discuss.
It's all going to be deleted anyway,
it's
so...
It's going to be, like, after the...
You wish.
Nothing to do with me.
Okay, so bringing it back to Brighton then, say we've recorded our stuff now, whatever. We all used to go down to gigs. I was talking to Jack about this last night. We all used to go to gigs when we could, because it was fun.
Yeah, we were always at the Fresh Point.
Can you recall any bands that we saw around this time that were, you know, that stood out?
Well, no.
Free Bar or Kendall Club?
80s Matchbox, Big Line.
They all blended into one. I mean,
that's your years of substance abuse, Ad. It's just
I used to...
As he scratched his nose.
funny thing was, I was standing at the bar the other day in the Mesmerist, and I started scratching my nose just because I had an itch. Some guy came up to me while I was queuing at the bar, and he said, "Can I pass my coke off you?" And I was like, "No." It's like, "Oh, come on, you got some money, haven't you?" I was like, "No." And it's like, started scratching his nose. I was like, "Sorry, I just had an itch, mate."
Is that like, the international sign of like, "Do you want to come by?"
Yeah. And he was like, "Oh, okay," and just bugged off.
He's with my allergies, I do that quite a lot. I'm always kind of.
Oh. Yeah. If he'd caught me on another day, I would have sorted him out. Sorted him out proper! Anyway, back to the show.
Well, so, okay, so we used to go to loads of gigs, especially the Cable Club was good.
Well, a lot of my first gigs were college related, so it would have been like
holy shit, yeah. You playing
self destruct. I've been self destruct.
Yeah. And then you playing everything else.
Yes.
And me playing well.
Yeah, going free, but we went to see 80s Mac Light Beyond Disaster.
I don't recall that.
Who actually became quite a big band.
I remember maybe seeing one gig with them.
One of the chaps on the singer was Guy. He's a singer. I knew him from around the corner from me.
We did quite a few gigs with Sean's band.
Grumpy Jack.
Yeah.
Remember going to Free Bar.
He keeps refusing to let me use any of the old Grumpy Jack stuff on the podcast.
Bastards.
So what
reason is he giving for this? He's not happy with the production? I mean, that would be the reason I would give for not using
it. It's probably the sounds.
Yeah.
It sounds... Actually, wasn't their guitarist using the GT3? So,
yes. Oh. He used to play surfing with the alien. Jay Satriani.
The worst.
He's just a short-ish guy, like young, very clean shaven. Like couldn't grow a beard like Mike.
Rose.
Yes, that guy. Yes. He's a good guitarist. Exactly, like, way better than I could ever be. Probably sing better as well.
Yeah, we should have got him in the band.
Toupee.
Toupee.
That was another band.
Do we get there?
Do you remember Toupee? Two bass players.
I think we supported them a couple of times. I can't remember where they were from, but I've actually spoken to one of the guys, Grant Sharkey, who comes and plays, does the circuit.
Ah, are they going to let you put their music on your podcast?
I don't know about that. I haven't asked.
Ask him.
I'll do my best. Okay.
But yeah, it's like two bass players and a drummer, and no guitarist.
Yeah.
Fucking crazy thing is that? But it worked.
It did work, quite well. Yeah. They were
fucking hell. You knew what about me?
Yeah. Do you remember going to see? I know you were there. You must have been there as well. We went to the Concord 2 to watch Turncoat. And we were just shouting, "This is unbelievable!"
Yes, yes. Yeah, and they might have played him. Only once, so.
I think they probably played once, but we were shouting it most of the gig.
Yeah. That was must have been quite early on.
Well, yeah, I remember that. I remember that because it was a competition they were doing to go and play Glastonbury.
Did they win it, though? Because they did play Glastonbury.
They did.
Yeah.
They did. And Simon from Cable Club side said to us, "Please try and make as much noise as possible for Turncoat." To try and get them to go through.
Right, okay.
Which obviously, Simon, being a top class geezer, we said, of course we will. Yeah. So we shouted a lot.
It was great.
When I say we shouted, it was Mike and I shouted a lot.
Well, it was always fun to see bands you knew up on stage anywhere, let alone the Concord.
Yeah, definitely. And they got through. So well done, Mike and Tyler.
it was good. It was quite interesting reading on their Facebook page about like their Glastonbury experience and sharing the backstage area with Kate Moss and Baby Shambles and that.
That's weird.
It is.
Yeah, but we have masks on tonight, don't we?
We did have masks.
Sharing backstage with Helps.
And Helps, yeah.
And a massive bag of weed. So yeah, there would have been lots of free, but there are. We're forgetting one of the first venues we would have started playing.
Free bar.
The Portland Rock Bar.
Yes. Now, the Portland Rock Bar was good for a few reasons. One of them, we actually came away with money at the end.
Yes, because we started selling t-shirts and merchandise.
No, and the main thing is you take all the money from the door entry.
Yeah, we
and
actually had well. Door entry as well.
But yeah, like we were selling t-shirts for a tenner each.
Which we had Jacko's mum doing, if I remember.
Yep. CDs were probably like a fiver.
Probably.
And 3 quid entry.
We had a whole pool table set up with all our merchandise.
I'm sure we came away from one gig and we had over 100 quid.
I think we had about 200.
My auntie and uncle brought a t-shirt, both there, from the Lego with men one.
Yeah, yeah.
And they wore it. Is that Shandy?
That's the one with the jacket.
They wore it to the next rock night.
I've still got my Lego. Oh no, I was going to say my Lego t-shirt. I've got my old Infurion t-shirt.
I've still got the crew one, yeah.
I had about
huge.
I had about 20 of them. Because I'd always wear a new one at a show and take it off and throw it out into the crowd.
Wow, but we could afford to do it in those days, the amount of money we were making.
Yeah, well, of course, yeah.
Well, the amount of money we're making in Portland, I'm unbelievable.
Being bankrupt from the Portland, yeah.
But yeah, and I'd throw them in the crowd. I didn't pay for one single t-shirt. But people had our t-shirt mark, so it was more important.
We had, I mean, later on we started giving away CDs, but at those early gigs at the the Portland, it was quite instrumental to have them on sale. It was nice to make a bit of money, but also people were actually asking for them because they wanted to listen to the music.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And because we spent so much time in the actual studio writing and recording the tracks and getting them on CD, that was tremendous. It was
Portland
and they played our set at the Portland.
The Portland was great.
Yeah.
Great venue to play at.
Sweaty.
That second or third one was because the fucking was the aircon had gone off or something.
I didn't even know they had aircon. The fact that we just turned up there with 2 4x12 with 100 watt fucking bell maps.
And that's where we first met the Subs.
Was it?
They supported us.
Is that because that's the same one as Best Left Dead? Because we played with Best Left Dead.
Yes, that's definitely where we first met Best Left Dead.
Yeah.
Because I remember Jed appearing, and we didn't really know anyone that was playing.
Is it? Yeah. I think this was the second time then. I think the first time we supported Kubrick at the time, but it was
Kubrick!
Yeah.
I say supported. They may have supported us.
And a shout out to Mary, who used to be the promoter, manager of Portland Rock Bar
at the time. Yeah, she was good.
Big up to Mary.
So the first gig we did was with Kubrick.
I think so, yeah.
So obviously
the link would have been through Chris.
Yeah. Oh my god.
So it must have been
the second one, yeah, we met. I remember we were unloading, Jed turned up and kind of introduced himself, and I just remember thinking,
This guy
looks mental, because he's like shaved head, massive beard, and looked like a pirate. And
hung like a pirate.
No, it looked like a pirate. I mean, I didn't see how his junk was hanging.
I suppose it hung like a pirate, sorry.
And he was just unloading PA gear, and I thought, well, he looks...
They had loads of gear, didn't they?
Pretty cool.
But at the time, I was talking to Jack about this yesterday, it was the Portland Rock Bar. It was an actual place for gigs. It was a proper
venue. Yeah, it was like...
Before it became like a fucking gastro eatery.
Exactly. Fans here all the time.
But that was so good to actually have. And we got to take all the money on the door, put someone on the door.
Yeah.
The bar was massive. The venue was massive. It was just...
Yeah, it was a massive
awesome
venue.
Yeah.
And I remember when we played with... Who's the... Tom's mate. Who was his business partner.
Hugh's home. So maybe they were on the same Kubrick gig then.
We played a gig with Q-Tone, or they support us, as people mainly did. And then we went to a show of Q-Tone in London.
In London, yeah.
A few days later.
Yeah. And we all went up in a bus.
I don't think I did.
But there was no one there.
No.
Okay, so kind of later on we started playing other places. Obviously we had the great cable club gigs and things. We already did the Portland.
Mike's not normally we professional with this, by the way. He's normally right with the banter. But carry on.
Oh no, I've got to edit this thing. I can make it sound how I want.
I love you, Mike.
I come on to my next question then.
I love you, Mike.
I come on to my next question. You once sat me down in a pub and complained about me writing all the songs, probably due to all the royalties I would receive. And then I put, do you feel that everyone's 0% share was fair in the end? Because we got no money for anything.
Hang on a minute. What, you're not getting royalties from our songs?
No, no one did, because we never got any royalties.
Oh, didn't we?
Did you?
Oh!
No, you bastard!
This is where he twists the knife!
Oh, maybe not. I edited that question to the one that I sent you earlier on, because that was a bit...
Whoa, did we have that conversation?
We did, yeah. He sat me down in the Hanover and...
So, yeah. Early gigs, pressure point, free
bar. Is it my round?
You want to go park up at your parents' side, don't you?
Oh, I vaguely do remember that, actually.
We used to get into, considering the band that we were, we used to get into far too many serious conversations about where we were going and what was going to happen.
Well, no, I think at the time that was kind of natural to do, but in hindsight, it was like...
Yeah, but...
What the fuck? Like, wait until we get there before we're having these discussions.
Yeah and no. Because, as we've all realised now, if you're not all on the same page, you're not going to go anywhere.
You can go the same place for a very short time. So some bands kind of like get there, they make it, they have an album or two, do really well, and then it falls apart because they're all like, what the fuck are we even doing?
Yeah.
So sometimes
and they go to different pages.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're on that same page for a long time, you can do anything. I was going to say to a certain extent, but no, that's rubbish. You can do anything if you're on the same page and all want the same thing. Unfortunately, we didn't. I'm going to end that conversation.
Oh, good. Well, next question.
I don't know. I don't think any of us...
The thing is, priorities come in the way. Like, girlfriends and, like, cinema.
I think none of us knew how to move on to that next level. And that actual next level would have probably been more than we were...
Harry.
That's appalling, so just don't bring that in. Oh. That would have been more than we could have actually achieved, I reckon.
Yeah. Well, the kind of band we weren't ever going to get anywhere else, really.
I think we could have done. I think things could have done, yes. If you were all going to be on that same page for a long time.
If you look at it from critical point of view, we gigged about, 10-15 times a year. It was basically in Brighton and a few gigs here and there elsewhere. And we would have had to do masses to actually get out there and we would literally have to give up our day jobs, be out there touring and just do gigging 100%. All the time.
And now looking back at things as well, one of us needed to drive.
None of us fucking drove. 100% one of us needed to drive.
Yeah, I'd like to take that moment to say thanks, Dad. Thanks, Sarah.
Yes.
Thanks, grandparents.
Yeah.
Dad, Sarah. Love you.
Yeah.
And taxi drivers, well done.
Yeah.
Estate taxi drivers that pick up all my drum kit.
Yeah.
Because it was a 9-piece.
Even though they looked really pissed off when they arrived. So.
Hey, they got extra £3 for that. you all need to be on the same page for a long time. And if you were, you could do anything you wanted.
No, but it's interesting though when you say like back then, you know, don't have full time jobs. Loads of the bands now, they still have full time jobs and they'll go out and play Glastonbury and Reading and all the festivals.
Yeah, but now you've got more of a sort of online presence and all that kind of business, which at the time there wasn't that really that thing going on where we were going.
It's just quite interesting the fact that a lot of these bands, you know, if their fans saw them in the street, they'd be, oh wow, hey, nice to see you. And they might be, oh well, I'm just off to my
presentation. Yeah, to work.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying we didn't try to be all on the same page. I'm saying that things happened.
No, the problem was I think we tried too much to be, but we weren't.
Yeah.
But things happened as well, also to people that affected.
We're all kind of trying to do something, but without any real direction as to how we would get there.